Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, my good friend Asphalt Andy from Laguna Beach.
My name's Andy. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and to be in this meeting tonight. And my nickname is Asphalt Andy. And I was also called Cement Head for the first 3 years. But before that, I just want to thank Mike for the opportunity to come talk in the meeting. It's always an honor and a privilege to talk in an AA meeting. A lot of men have given a lot of their time for free to me. And my life's better than it's ever been before. And it's because of those guys. So anytime anybody calls me to do that, I love it. My ego likes to be in front of people, but my sober adult self is just scared to death. You know? So I'm a fall down drunk. That's my experience. I like to drink, and sometimes I like to fall down. There was a night towards the end of my drinking, my girlfriend and I were at the beach. We had been drinking all day. And it started to rain a little bit, so we decided to go back to the house. I lived right across from the women's club in Laguna Beach, about two blocks up from the beach. And we were both training for a marathon. We never ran more than 3 or 4 miles at a time, and we never ended up running any marathons, but we were alcoholic, so we thought we were training for a marathon. And, nothing in moderation. So it was raining, and I didn't want her feet to get wet, so I started giving her a piggyback ride, and I'm running full trot across PCH, and I remember thinking, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And so I've got her, you know, behind legs, and I'm holding on, and I ran, and I got to the top of the driveway, and it kind of leveled out, and I tripped and fell. And we fell on my head. They had just freshly paved that asphalt driveway a couple weeks before that. And when we landed, I didn't want to lift my head up because I knew I'd lose my nose and my whatever else. So I just bared down. And fortunately, she was okay because she just landed on me. And I didn't do so well. So when we both kind of came to, she got me inside. And I knew it wasn't going well after about 3 or 4 big gauze pads just completely bled through. And she put them aside and could put new ones on. My blood was thin, it was an abrasion, and it just wouldn't stop bleeding. So she finally got me set up and got me on the couch. And the first thing I said was, give me a glass of wine. Right? I mean, you know, what else? And she wouldn't give me any wine, and we couldn't go to the emergency room because we were both hammered and couldn't get it together. So we eventually just passed out. I went to the doctor the next morning. It was an assistant. He took me over to the sink and said, why don't we splash some water on this to rinse it off? So I never really got any care for it. For the next 3 months, gravel was growing out of my forehead as it worked its way out, and I had an abrasion that went like this, and it was colored dark gray. I had a big scab on my nose. My eye was puffed closed. It wasn't pretty. And at that time, I was a music teacher. I taught music 4 days a week to kids and housewives, 6 to 8 at a time. So I called in sick the first day, but the next day I went in to teach, and by the end of the day, the bandage would bleed through. And so the kids were just kind of freaked out, right? And so the next week, they bring their parents in to say, look what happened to Andy. Oh, my God. So now I have to come up with these bullshit stories about what happened. And it wasn't pretty. About 4 or 5 months after that, I went to a doctor. And I asked him if he could help me. And he said, Andy, you have a post-traumatic asphalt tattoo. And I said, well, what's that? Because by then, it had kind of cleaned up, but there was this big part that wasn't getting any better, and the skin was all flat, and because there's nothing between your skin and your skull, right? So it wasn't looking good. And he said, yeah, I've seen it on people on motorcycles, like on their legs and stuff when they have accidents. And he kind of stopped and he said, but I've never seen it on someone's face. Oh God, you know. And I'm like really depressed. Things are not. I'm drinking every night. I just can't, you know. And I was so happy to have made his day. I could see him in the cafeteria later that day, like, oh, you guys, you wouldn't believe this guy I saw. It was not good. And I didn't know then, and this was towards the end for me, but I didn't know that I was alcoholic. And I'd even been in AA before. I didn't know that when I started drinking, I didn't have control over the amount I took. And it took me a long time in AA to even figure that out, because the denial, right, was so heavy just to stay in the world. And I was so tense, just as a person. I was so stressed out. I was overachieving just to be normal with everybody else. And I got that from my family. Now, I'm not blaming my family for my alcoholism. My immediate family, they're all squares. None of them drink a lot. My brother used to do cocaine in clubs with me in San Francisco. And then he'd go home and say, hey, my friend up on the 8th floor has got some more. Do you want to go do it? And I'd be like, yeah, that sounds great. Come on, let's go. And he'd be like, no, I'm kind of tired. Let's go home. I couldn't. He didn't have the addiction thing. The only person in my family that I know of was my grandfather's brother. He died from drinking. I never heard a lot about it. That's the only connection I can make. So in my family, there's these two really different sides. On my dad's side, you have the obsessive compulsive disorder people who are perfectionists. There's some physicists and engineers on that side. They're all really stressed out, and they go to prep school. They get rid of their kids when they're 12 and, you know, make sure they're doctors or whatever. And on the other side, on my mom's side, there's the heavy drinking partiers from Ohio. Round on the outside, high in the middle, man, they love to party. And when I was 10 years old, I'd go to these family reunions in Ohio, and they'd have kegs of Stroh's in the refrigerator. And even as a little 10-year-old, you know, all my uncles with the big sideburns, and they're just partying, and I thought, this is it, man, this is fun. I even knew that. But unfortunately, with the heavy drinking comes the depression. So as a kid, my tools for living, when I didn't feel good, where I got to overachieve just to be level with you. I got to be a perfectionist, which is a recipe for failure. And then when I start to feel bad about that, I'm going to drink and then get depressed. So it was no surprise when I had my first drink that it was an incredible release. And the first time I drank, I got drunk. I was 12 years old. I was at a bar mitzvah. It was a double bar mitzvah. And these two kids who were 13 that my family knew, and I'm not Jewish. So me and the one other non-Jewish kid found the trash cans full of ice and bottles of champagne. And all the parents, after the excruciating 3 or 4 hour ceremony, or whatever you want to call it, they're all having dinner and partying in this big ballroom. Well, we had as much as we could drink. And I'm 12 years old, and I'm thinking, oh, I've heard about this alcohol thing. It's time. So we got completely hammered. And by the end of the night, 4 or 5 hours later, they find me on the playground stuff, you know, the playground equipment in the back of the synagogue. And my mom finally comes and collects me and takes me in. And it's an embarrassment for the family and all that. But I think it's great. I think it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I told everybody about it. I thought it was fun. And from there on out, every time I drank, I got drunk. Oh, that's cool. So I went to high school, somehow graduated high school and got into a decent college. I went to UC Irvine, and I got my 4-year degree in 6 years. I was on the 6-year program, and I used to say that college was a big distraction from what I really wanted to do, which was to play in my band and smoke weed and listen to Jimi Hendrix. And I did a lot of that and played a lot of gigs and did tours and somehow still graduated. And I remember my therapist at the time. I've had therapists for a long time because I knew there was something wrong with me. And I told him, I'm drinking too much, I'm using too much, can you help me? He offered me a joint on the way through Aldrich Park after graduation. And of course I took it, you know, but I just couldn't figure it out. It wasn't working well. So I got my 6-year degree in psychology, and I studied economics and music as well, and I got my first job. I got a job selling guitars at Guitar Center. And my parents were so proud of me, you know, finally getting that degree. And working for commission at Guitar Center. I did it for 9 months. I loved it while I was there. I loved guitars. I loved being around them. I'd show up early. And, of course, everybody who works at Guitar Center partied like I did. So it was a lot of fun. But after 9 months, I just couldn't do it anymore. And so I got the job that I kept until I almost stopped drinking, actually. One of the guys there bought a music store, and they needed a group guitar teacher. And that's when I started teaching guitar. So now I'm teaching 4 nights a week. 6 to 8 students at a time, and I have 100 students a week. I am a group guitar teacher. And it reminded me every day that I hadn't, you know, made it. in music, but I didn't care. It was a job, and at the same time, I played twice a week at local clubs and bars. I remember the pinnacle of my music career was I got the coveted Monday night spot at the Sandpiper in Laguna Beach. Yeah, sometimes there's more people in the band than there are actually at the club. But it was a lot of fun, and we got free drinks. And then I play on the weekend as well. So at this point, I just was a professional party animal. I'd teach from 3 to 10 at night, get off, smoke out, you know, drive home for an hour, and then go to the clubs, and then party until 3 or 4 in the morning, and then pass out, and then get up and get to work at 3. And it worked really well for a long time. Until somebody introduced me to an outside issue, and within 3 months I was in my first 12-step meeting. Just completely took me down. I had no idea what was happening. And I asked somebody to be my sponsor in my first meeting, and he said, sure. And due to my schedule, he told me, you know, you should go to 12 o'clock noon meetings at the Candy Club. Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Now, I'm not an alcoholic yet. I'm a drug addict. And the whole idea of not drinking beer for the Super Bowl and when I get married and New Year's Eve when I'm 50, you know, like, I couldn't fathom that. But he said, just go. It's the program. Same thing. Just, you know, substitute it. So I started going, and I got sober for 8 months. I was 24 years old, and my girlfriend went on vacation with her family for a month, and I drank right away because she was my higher power. And it was on again, and eventually I remember I got the call from her saying, I never thought it would be me whose feelings would change. And I was told by my first sponsor later, Andy, she had to either choose between law school and having a life or being with you. I mean, it wasn't a hard decision, you know. And that hurt, you know, my feelings. But it really was a tough thing. And at that point, for the next year, I drove through Laguna Canyon, and they were building the toll roads at that time. And it was still two lanes really close, and there were just cement truck after cement truck coming through the canyon. I'm in my little Honda Civic, and I just thought, if I could just a little turn, just take off the seatbelt every morning. And I never did it, and I'd get through my work, and I'd cry in the car like a running baby, and then drive home and drink. And it was miserable, but after a year, I got through it, and I joined a band in Laguna Beach, and really went on my last run. I remember I was at a rehearsal at my house, and the other guitar player came over, and I didn't know that he was one of the biggest coke dealers in Laguna Beach at that time. And he said, "You want a bump?" And it was like that slow motion thing that happens when you're in like a car crash. I just went, "Oh man, I've been to meetings. I have a really, really big problem with cocaine, and if I drink, I'm fucked because then I'll do the stuff. And oh my god!" And I was in the program. I had no higher power. I just said, "Okay." And for the next 2 years, I just partied with this guy. We played together twice a week and went back to his place and basically just partied with as much of anything we wanted. And it just destroyed me. And I started to get later into my 20s, and it wasn't so cool anymore. And some of my friends started getting married, right? Because they, like, have jobs and nice cars that they pay for and stuff. And I started going to these weddings, and my amateur friends would party with me. And I remember one night, I took my friend Brad home at 7 in the morning on Sunday after partying all night, and in my little Honda Civic, doing 125 miles an hour through Mulholland. We were in Hollywood, through Mulholland, and then on the 101, and took him home. And my brother found out about it, and he called me on it, and he called me and said, "I heard you were driving Brad home, doing 125 in your Honda Civic. Like, what the fuck are you doing?" And I just said, "Yeah, you're right." And that's when I started making the promises that I hear people talk about. I started to realize maybe I really do have a problem with alcohol and everything else. Because I could admit to the drugs. The drugs took me down immediately. I'm on the NA hotline phone talking to people that I knew from meetings right away. I mean, it's just horrible. But the alcohol, I just couldn't get there. And so I started making the promise, I'll never drink and drive again. I'll never drink and drive again. And then I would drive again drunk. And I did it again. I won't do it. And I did it again. And the last night I drank, I drove. Because I don't know what the fuck's going to happen when I drink. And it was a normal night. I started up in PV. It was 4th of July. I was playing with the band. I made some cash. Came back to Laguna Beach. Started at the Royal Hawaiian. Watched the fireworks. A bunch of friends were in town. And just went south. Stopped by all the bars. And eventually we're at the Sandpiper. They surfed till 1:45. And it's like 1 o'clock, and I'm like a big shot, Sandpiper big shot, because they know me there, and so I get all my friends in, and it gets to 1:45, and I'm blacking out. I black out all the time, and I lost everybody. And I started to realize, I need to go see that guy in South Laguna. And I could remember his number, and now I'm running again, right? With the post, the thing, and the I get in the alley, and I run home. I use my roommate's phone, because mine doesn't work anymore. And I call this guy who, you know, the guy. You give him some money, and he'll, you know, exchange it for stuff. And so I get in the car, and I start driving. Now it's 2 o'clock a.m. I'm at Aliso Beach, right where the cops hang out, if anybody's familiar with that spot. And I'm going over that the bridge, the old bridge, and it kind of narrows there a little bit, and there's a big curb, and I hit on the right side, I black out. And I realize, oh, shit, I'm and boom, I hit. I bend both rims on the right side of the car. I blow both tires out. I get blown back into the road. I'm swerving around right, you know, where the cops, like I'm looking where the cops hang out. They're just not there. And I somehow pull over and I park, and I start going, God, should I just walk? Could I walk? But maybe he'll fall asleep. Well, this guy was always awake, right? The guy's always awake. But, you know what I mean? And I start going back and forth. Should I go? And I finally make the decision. I'll just change the tire, right? Because I can see the front tire's fucked up. I'll change the tire, right? And I'm looking where the guy cop. Nope, the man's not there. But I'm in a two-door 1986 Honda Civic hatchback, and the drums and all my guitar equipment are in the back, and the spare tire's in the bottom. So I take all the drums out, my Marshall half stack, all the crap, you know. So now I'm the drunk guy with the fucked up car and with the band equipment on the side. I get the fucking tire, I change the tire, I put all the stuff back in, and I drive to like 5 or 6 blocks to the guy's house. And I park my car at 7-Eleven on 3rd Street, not to give the guy's location away. He's in jail now. Don't worry about it. But and I go and I pick up, and I was so fucked up that the drug dealer said, "Man, you're too hammered. Why don't you just crash on my bed?" So I crashed on the coke dealer's bed, and got up in the morning. And at that time, one of my main gigs was at a church. I played in a church band every Sunday. Not that I was religious at all, you know, and. I know it's an anonymous program, but this is the big cathedral made out of crystal, and I'm playing there every Sunday, and what I realize is I'm supposed to play this Sunday, and there's no fucking way I'm playing. And the drummer in the praise band, his equipment is in my car. So I call him. He wakes up the choir director, who, because he doesn't have a car, right? We're all fucked up, and drives him to pick up the stuff. He comes in, gets the keys, and takes off. And I remember thinking, how the fuck did this happen? Because if any of you have been drunk all the time, sometimes you slip into one of these situations where you're at a really creepy drug dealer's house. And I mean, there was the drug dealer's girlfriend who's just like bone thin, and there's something in her purse she has to get. And she's over there dumping it out, just like sifting through all her tweak debris, like, what the fuck, you know? And then there's the guy in the little bathroom downstairs, you doing just like, God. It's yeah, it's like that, and I get my shit and I call a cab, and the guy comes and takes me home, and I have my last drink that 5th of July, 1998. I drank this day old warm imported beer that was on the coffee table, trying to come down, and some friends of mine came by. I live between the Sandpiper and the Marine Room, so people are always coming by, and he said, "Man, you look like shit. You look really bad." And I would end up meeting this guy in AA many years later. And I had some soup or something. And I remember saying to myself, I guess I should go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd been here before, and I never wanted to come back. When I was 24, there was a guy who was yellow, and he took a year in the 7 a.m. meeting. And I remember, you know, he said his thing, and he came out, and people would share and say, "Hey, good going, Greg," or whatever his name is. "You know, your eyes aren't yellow anymore. This is awesome. He's not yellow." And I'm sitting there going, like, I'm 24. Like, this guy's yellow? What am I doing here? And I was, it didn't matter. I was ready to come back. So, like most new people, I started going to new meetings because of my schedule. I knew the people there. And I instructed everyone that if you were alcoholic, you shouldn't go out because it really sucks. And they were happy to, you know, they kind of, okay, Andy, thank you for telling us. And I started to get sober, and I couldn't stay sober. I smoked pot after a month, and I was instantly paranoid, and so I really got sober, and I came back, and I started taking clean shifts at the new meetings, and it was a nightmare. I knew after 30 days I was going to drink. I mean, there was just no question in my mind, I'm going to drink. And I'm at Main Beach, and all of a sudden I'm seeing AA people, you know. And I remember seeing these guys and thinking, like, this guy just wants to be my sponsor, right? He's going to come over. And I was just fucked up. And I called this guy, a family friend, who had called me out at an Easter party years ago. Actually, it wasn't that long before, because I had the post-traumatic asshole tattoo and long hair. No offense to any of the long hairs in this meeting. Sorry, you guys, but if you look like me, kind of like a square guy, it helps when you show up for the gig as a guitar player. You have some long hair. People actually take you seriously. And so I called him, and his name's Craig. Craig S. from Redondo Beach. Craig S. from Redondo Beach saved my life. And I know that the sponsor doesn't keep you sober. God keeps me sober today, and the meetings and the 12 steps and all those things. But I was one of those guys who needed somebody like Craig S. And I called him, and I said, and I just started explaining, you know, the depth of my difficulties. All the girls have left. They keep saying I drink too much. And she left. And I hate my job. And I crashed my car. And, you know, just on and on and on and on. And he listened. And he said, and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? And I remember thinking, like, is that some weird Alcoholics Anonymous guru shit? Like, what is that? And this guy clearly didn't just listen to all the shit I just said. Doesn't he have like some solution, like, hey man, it'll get better, or anything like that? And I remember thinking all that, but I didn't have a plan, so I just said, okay. And from that day on, for the next year, year and a half, I went to go see Craig every Saturday at his place. And fortunately, I didn't have anything, you know, on my calendar. I didn't have any dates pending or anything like that. So I'd go spend the day with Craig. And Craig was about 300 pounds. He was, 6 foot 4. He also had a ponytail. And he would talk really loud about God in public restaurants. And I'm like sitting there just going, and he was like broke. He lived in this crappy little apartment. But I didn't care. He knew AA, and I knew that he knew AA. And he had what I wanted, which was he just didn't give a shit. He was happy, he was sober, and that's what mattered, period. And he was like 100% AA all the time. And so he started telling me things, like, you need to get a meeting schedule. And I said, well, what meetings do I go to? You need to get a men's tag meeting. You need to get a step study meeting. You need to get a 12-and-12 meeting. You need to have a weekend meeting where you can go just look at the girls. You need to have a speaker meeting where you can just go hang out. You know, all this stuff. And I would just do what he said. And so I go there Saturday, we ride bikes, have cheeseburgers, we go home and read the book, and then we go to a meeting. And I remember when we started reading the book, we started with the Roman numerals, right? And I need help, and I know I need help. My life is not going well. And we're reading, you know, the introduction stuff, and I remember just thinking I'd get really, like, agitated, and I'd be like, what the fuck, man, this guy, what doesn't he, you know? And then he'd just get up and walk away. And I'd be like, oh shit, this is not good. He's going to not sponsor me. I need this guy. And then he'd come back. And it turned out he had asthma. He was just going to use an inhaler. But I thought, like, oh, something's wrong. He's like trying to school me. But I didn't have a plan. And I was 100% willing. And I started to work this stuff with this guy. And I started to go to meetings. And one day I was going to the noon meeting. And I'm a sit-in-the-back-row guy, as you know, Mike. And I'm sitting in the back row, and I'm trying not to let anybody notice me or pay attention to me. And I'm driving in that same Honda Civic that I'd blown the wheels and tires out on. And I remember the mechanics told me, you have a broken controller arm on your Civic. And I thought, that's perfect. I do have a broken controller arm. And so they fix it, and they patched it up. And in the candy club, there's this pothole when you first come in. And I'm kind of a people-pleasing alcoholic, so I want to get out of the way so people can go. So I cruise in, I hit that pothole, and my wheel just comes off my car. And my car just slides to a stop right in the middle of the driveway, blocking any traffic coming in and out. And fortunately, I was late. So everybody inside the candy club kind of just like does this and goes like, well, fuck, it's that new guy. And it took over an hour for the guy to get the car out of the way. So everybody's waiting because they have jobs and stuff, right? They're all waiting to get out. And he finally pulls it over and I'm just sitting there and everybody drives by and just goes, oh, there's a new guy. Oh, there's a new guy. Oh, and I'm sitting there, post-traumatic asshole tattoo, pasty white because I'm not getting any sun at all. I got the long, sensitive ponytail. I mean, I'm like hurting. This is not good. And it was brutal. And I just had so much baggage. And the good thing is, the next week, people said, hey, how's your car? I mean, it's like I got to be known as that guy with asphalt on his head, right? I mean, it's just, you can't hide. And I'm anonymous. And I just kept going to see Craig. Craig S. Redondo Beach. And pretty soon we're doing the second step. Came to believe. And I realized, I was talking about that this week. Came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Now, first step was no problem. Powerless over alcohol, life's unmanageable, like, check. Second step, because every day I'd wake up and look in the mirror, you know, and eventually I started to do good and get a better job or whatever, and I'd be like, yeah, maybe this fucking alcohol. And I'd look in the mirror and just go, oh, fuck, okay. You know, fuck it. And so came to believe. And that was perfect. He explained this stuff to me in a way that I can understand, which means you don't need to believe right now. It just means you've been here before. You see people who you know are like you, and they have good lives now. That just means a little willingness. So come to believe fully later, but just give it a chance. Just open the door a little bit. And so I thought, well, okay, I can do that. And next thing you know, we're doing the third step. And I got a big problem with God, you know, for whatever reason. Next thing you know, he's got me by the hand, and he's leaning, you know, he's like kneeling next to his coffee table, and he's like, we're going to pray. And I remember looking around thinking, like, because he's got this apartment with windows right by the pool and stuff, and I'm like, what if somebody sees us in here? This is weird, you know, because I'm paranoid, done a lot of acid and a lot of other stuff, and it was okay, you know, so we do the third step, and I remember just going like, all right, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do, all right, and I'm praying to God, I don't understand. I love Earl H. He says, his approval was not necessary. I mean, I just love that. Like, it didn't matter what I thought. Just get out of the way, you know, just start turning my will of my life over to something other than myself. Now, I'm really into nature, and I'm really into backpacking and mountain climbing. And fortunately, when I had 2 weeks of sobriety, I borrowed my mom's car, the one that did work, and took off for 2 weeks. And I'd have this trip planned, and I remember thinking, like, wow, I'm going to go and not drink or use anything. And I journaled the whole time, and I found my higher power in the Grand Tetons. And what worked for me just a little bit at that time was nature. Just, I got it. Like, I'm looking at these huge mountains going, like, well, clearly, I didn't have anything to do with this, and it's been here a long time, so I'll just, whatever that power is, I'll go with that. And now he's got me doing the fourth step. And I'm one of those people, the first person on my fourth step, me. You know, I was resentful of myself that I'm an alcoholic. And did my family, did all that stuff. And it took about a year to finish it. And I remember he said, okay, well, you're done with your fourth step. Come on over Saturday and we'll do your fifth step. And I'm thinking, cool, that's great. So we do the bike thing. We, you know, eat the cheeseburgers and do all that. And we come back. He's, you know, pretty hefty guy. So he's got his thing of cookies. And I get through me and like one family member. And he's like passing out. You know, he's like sugar overdose. Oh, yeah, that's great. And he says, we'll just come back next week. We'll finish it up then. And I didn't know how you're supposed to do your fifth step or if this was normal or whatever. So I go, oh, okay. So I come back the next week. We do like a little bit more and he kind of crashes again. It took three sittings to finish my fourth step. And I didn't realize that's not normal. I sponsor people since then. I would never make somebody wait 3 weeks to finish their fifth step. It's a lot of shit to sit on and be super aware of. You know what I mean? Defects of character is just like, oh my God. But I finished it. And he told me what to read to do the sixth and seventh step when I got home. And I felt like I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I could go to any meeting and I could sit in the meeting and know I actually belong here. Pretty soon I did my eighth step. And I was really self-focused, self-centered, as I've heard is common around here. And I had an ex-girlfriend that I wanted to make amends to so I could maybe work things out, you know. And so when it was time to do my ninth step, he said, talk to me before you go to anybody. And I finally found her. It was the girl who said I thought my feelings would never change. And turns out she worked at the Orange County Juvenile Justice Department. She had finished her law degree and she was helping kids and stuff and all that kind of good stuff. So I found her and I called her and I said, hey, I'm sober and I'd like to make amends to you. And her stepfather was sober and she wasn't buying it. She said, really? You got a sponsor? I said, yeah, actually it's Craig S. in Redondo Beach and all the stuff. And she believed me enough, so we went and had coffee. And I went to go see her. And I knew exactly what my part was and everything. And I knew how to kind of keep it clean. And we had coffee, and I told her what was going on. And she said, Andy, I had some stuff too. And we talked about that. And then she put her hand up on the table, and she had a huge diamond ring. And she said, I'm engaged. And I said, that's awesome. Thank you, so much. And I was like, let's get the fuck out of here. Because I'm going to start crying or something. So I dropped her off, and I drove to some park and just was like crying and stuff. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me because it was over. There was no more like, well, maybe I can get back together with her. It was done. And it was clean. I was good, and I could eventually start dating and not have any weird issues about it. And that took a long time, actually. And then it was time for the 10th step, continuing to try to apply all these steps to my life. And for me, what that meant was, as an example, I was tired of being a guitar teacher. I didn't want to be a guitar teacher anymore. Now, fortunately, the singer in my college band started an appraisal company, and it's 98, 99, right? The whole thing's really picking up, and he needs somebody to train. I tried to train with him when I was drunk, and I was always too hungover. So he trained me, and in 6 months, he said, okay, you got to get out of here. You got to go get your own clients. And so now, I'm kind of cleaned up a little bit, but I don't have the tattoo removed and stuff, but I have to go into offices and try to sell myself as somebody who can do a good job. And I'm in the bathroom now, and I'm praying. And I'm not praying, please help me make money. I'm praying, just help me accept whatever's supposed to happen. If this is not what I'm supposed to be doing, okay, then I'll do something else. Thanks for telling me, And I worked really, really hard. And I started to become a workaholic. I'm trying to be a perfectionist and trying to compensate for how bad I feel about myself, and my sponsor had moved, and so I finally got a new sponsor, David D. He's in Laguna Beach, and I see him every Monday. He's at my Monday Night Men's Stag Meeting, that's my home group, and he kind of picked up from there, and that meeting helped me tremendously. I started to go on a retreat 2 times a year with them. Eventually I was the secretary of the retreat. Eventually I started getting a lot of commitments. I did the GSR commitment. I know, I'm sorry, man. It's 2 years. Yeah. Be careful when you're done with 2 years. I got horned into being the registrar, so it was 4 years. Yeah. Anyway, so a lot of people made fun of being a GSR, but it's a great commitment, and it kept me sober into my 9th year. And I'm really grateful for that commitment. And I've been in that play, actually. The play's kind of fun. Tradition State play, November 11th. And things started to get good. After 3 years, I had saved enough money to get the asphalt removed from my forehead. There's a sober plastic surgeon in Alcoholics Anonymous, it turns out. And so I went to go see him, and it took 3 procedures. They cut some of it out and then sew it together and let it stretch, and then cut some more out and do it again. And I'm sober, so I'm not going to take anything, And it was just, whatever. It was nuts. Basically, I had 3 facelifts right in the middle of my forehead. And after each one, I didn't realize, they put these bandages on. And it turns out, they're Steri-Strips, right? And it turns out, and I didn't even see this coming, that it comes in the shape of an L. An L. And now I'm really humbled. And there's something I can do about it. I remember they take it off. Yeah, and if anybody's had plastic surgery, they don't use little stitches. It's like full-on black Frankenstein stitches. So I'm like, well, I guess I got to leave these on. And the funny thing, it was about that time that people started saying, hey, will you come leave this meeting? And I remember right after I got one of the things done, I had this L on my forehead, and it was at the hospital in Laguna Beach. The bottom floor, you guys have probably been in that meeting. It's a big meeting, They bring all the people down from Genesis program, and it's just, and I get up, and I just, I'm like, if you're in the back row and you can't see, I have a big L on my forehead. It was just, really, really. Alcoholics Anonymous has kept me extremely humble and extremely grateful. Very, very grateful to be here. And eventually I got out of that job I didn't like. I just play guitar for fun now and built my own business, and it worked out. And eventually I got married. I met this wonderful, wonderful woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. My friends used to say there was bad Andy and good Andy, and I could never figure out which one I was. And eventually I found the gray area, And she's a school teacher. She's been a school teacher for the same amount of time I've been working in the same industry since 98. And she's just this beautiful, good person. Total sweetheart. Just a wonderful person. And it's and I just don't deserve it, right? I'm thinking, this is unbelievable. How am I going to... We actually met twice. And the first time, we went on 3 dates. And after the third date, I didn't call her again because I was going camping or something. And she had read that book, like, How to Date Correctly or some shit. And if the guy doesn't call you back soon enough, that's it. You're done. And I just didn't think I was good enough. I didn't know what was going on. And I ended up meeting her 2.5 years later. And in 6 months, we were engaged. And then 5 months after that, we were married. And it's the best thing that ever happened to me. My dad's got the OCD thing. And I really, really struggled with that. And I'd never lived with anybody. And she has really helped me just become a normal person. Not normal, but, you know, able to live with someone else. And things were going really well. And after about a year, she was pregnant. And we both really, really wanted to have a family. I wanted to have a family of my own. I'm the only person in my family who's going to carry on any of these either families. It just works out that way. And I couldn't believe it. I just thought, this is the best. Clearly, this is God's will, that things are going so well for me. And at 5 months, we lost a baby. And I remember just thinking, oh my God. And the first thing I did was call my sponsor. And the good thing is, I do AA. I mean, at that point, I think I had like 12 years of sobriety. And I remember, like, I'm one of those AA nerds. I just go to AA. And when I don't like it, I go. And the good thing is, my sponsor explained this to me later, that when the shit hits the fan, I'm current with this guy. I can call him and say, hey, you know, and boom, he knew exactly what to do. And I got the help from AA that I needed. And I just kept going to my meetings. And I'm in shock. I don't know what the hell to do. And then people are asking me, like, what the fuck happened? And I'm trying to explain. I mean, it was not good. And but the first thing I thought was, I made a deal several years ago, step three, with Craig in his apartment building. I'm going to turn my will and my life over to care of a God that I don't understand. And apparently, this is what's supposed to happen. This wouldn't be my will, but I'm trying not to live in my will anymore. And we started going through fertility, and I don't know if any of you have gone through that, but it is a really, really expensive nightmare for the guy, and for the woman, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine how horrible it is. And, you know, I'm going to stay out of the results, but I'm still going to, we still continue to take the action, the appropriate action to try to get pregnant. And I don't know if that's going to happen. It might. It's been 5 years. But it's taken that long. And about 2 years after it all went down, I went through about a 2.5 year depression where I just couldn't get off the couch. You know, I'm isolating. I'm going to my meetings, and that's about it. And I'm a real estate appraiser. So at about the same time, the whole real estate, you know, finance industry went to shit. So I'm not working, and I'm sitting at home doing nothing. And fortunately, the only thing I thought of to do was to go reconnect with my higher power. Now, I had this really little idea what a higher power was, like just enough to do business with. But before you know it, I'm in Yosemite, and it was June 3 years ago, and it was a really heavy snow year, and I'd been out for 3 days. This is my fourth day. I'm by myself, and I'm coming through, and I can see the glaciers, the snowfields, and I can see the water coming down, and there's just beautiful flowers everywhere, and the Merced River is going along, and I'm walking along this path, and it happened. And I had 10 minutes where I didn't think about anything. I started doing the 11-step prayer, meditation, and trying to just let my thoughts go by, and it happened. And I realized what my higher power was, and I felt it, and I could see it all around me, and I started to feel better. And I explained this to my sponsor, because he was telling me, you need to broaden your idea of what a higher power is. And every summer now, I go on 4 or 5 trips in the Sierras, and being an alcoholic, I want to, you know, go on the longest, biggest deal trail. So last summer I did the John Muir Trail, most of it by myself, and ended up on the top of Mount Whitney. It's 220 miles from Yosemite Valley all the way to the top of Mount Whitney. I did about 40 miles with my wife and some friends, and the rest of it by myself. And it took about 10 days. So I'm walking 16 miles a day with a little backpack on my back, as simple as possible, and just working that shit out, you know, writing a little bit. And then this year I did a lot of the same stuff, This year I did something called the Sierra High Route. I don't know if anybody even knows what that is. I had no idea. But essentially it's a route that this mountain climber from the 70s designed, and it goes from Kings Canyon all the way to north of Yosemite, and it stays off any trail except for about 10 miles. So it's literally just, there's this lake and there's a mountain, and you just go around the left side. And he purposefully doesn't tell you where to go because he wants it to be like the original explorers. And so I did about 60, 70 miles that this summer, and it was unbelievable. I feel my higher power out there, and I can get out of my own way. And so now I just try to bring it, that same feeling back to me at home. And I found a really, really peaceful place in the last year. And to me, there's no contingent sobriety. Sobriety is just, I get to be sober today. And if I'm lucky, I get to give it back. There's no, I want to get sober if I get a nice car or get a nice job or any of that shit. It's just, I get to be sober today. And the fact that I get to have a relationship with another human being is fucking awesome. All those things are icing on the cake. But just being sober is, that's enough. Work the steps, get comfortable in my own skin, and be sober. I spent a lot of time listening to speaker tapes. And there's a guy named Earl H. who's got one of my favorite pitches. And I'll end with something that I've heard him say and I really like. And he just says, I wish, and I probably won't get this right, but I wish something that's very, very hard for us alcoholics to find, and that's, I wish you peace. Thank you.